Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Medical Monday, March 3rd. I'm Ray Graff. Support comes from Berkshire Plastic Surgeons in Great Barrington and Pittsfield, offering skin cancer screenings, Botox injections, fillers, cosmetic, and reconstructive surgery. BerkshirePlasticSurgeons.com. On this Medical Monday, we welcome Dr. Alan Schaefer, a sleep and obesity medicine specialist at St. Peter's Sleep Center. Dr. Schaefer is board certified in pulmonary critical care, sleep medicine, and obesity medicine, and accredited in metabolic health. We'll talk about some areas that directly impact sleep, as well as metabolic health and diabetes. Get your calls in early, 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551, or email voxpop@wamc.org. Back after the news. Hello again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. It's Medical Monday today. Joining us is Dr. Alan Schaefer, a sleep and obesity medicine specialist at St. Peter's Sleep Center. Dr. Schaefer is board certified in pulmonary critical care, sleep medicine, and obesity medicine, and accredited in metabolic health. Dr. Schaefer specializes in the diagnosis and treatment of chronic sleep disorders, including apnea, insomnia, narcolepsy, as well as obesity medicine and metabolic health. He has been practicing sleep medicine for nearly 30 years, starting the first sleep center in Orange County, New York, in 1997. He also has some personal experience with sleep disorders, having been diagnosed with sleep apnea himself in 2006. He lost 50 pounds in 2008, which furthered his interest in metabolic health. If you have a question for Dr. Schaefer today, give us a call. 800-348-2551 is the number, 1-800-348-2551, or you can email the program at voxpop@wamc.org. Dr. Alan Schaefer, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
You look wide awake.
I certainly am.
Good for you. You know, the daylight savings time is coming, and in my house, it annoys us greatly. I have had enough of the time shift. What does it do to the body?
Well, we are pushing our clock an hour ahead, but our body doesn't know that.
Right.
And outside, there isn't a one-hour shift in the sunrise and sunset. So we develop what's called circadian misalignment. So our body's normal light sleep-wake cycle is changed by the social clock that we get by turning the clocks ahead. But again, outdoors, the light, our internal clock, and the social clock, the time that it is, are misaligned. And this is associated with several health problems. It's been studied and it's been shown that during the transition to daylight savings, there's an increased risk of heart attacks. There's an increased incidence of strokes, hospital admissions.
Do we know why?
It's generally it's sort of hard to explain. The exact mechanisms are not quite clear, but when you're stressing when you're stressing the system, there's chronic stress has been shown recently to be a significant health hazard. And this is what, you know, simplistically, that's what I see as going on because and the other thing that happens as we're staying up later, we still have to get up the same time for school or for work, we're getting less sleep. And it's been shown that getting less sleep stresses the body and increases your risk for all these cardiovascular problems, as well as for diabetes, insulin resistance, obesity, and that's where this all links together for me.
All right, I want to get to the connection between diabetes and obesity and lack of sleep in a minute, because the question I have is one leading to the other, or is the other leading to one? I mean, where's the cart and where's the horse? But let's get to that in a minute. You said when we get less sleep, these health problems happen. How much sleep does Dr. Schaefer think we should get every night?
Well, the recommendations are 7.5 to 8 hours per night.
Are you on board with those recommendations?
I am very much on board with those recommendations. I were personally more on board with them, but yes.
Okay, but all right. And almost every doctor I'll talk to says, yeah, get your 8 hours.
Yep.
But
mm-hmm.
Doctors are pretty busy, so yep. you don't get your 8 all the time.
Not all the time.
So what do you do? How do you compensate?
I will maybe have a little bit more coffee. I'm not a big caffeine user, but there are ways to follow good sleep hygiene habits. Okay, I try not to nap during the day because that could impact nocturnal sleep.
Then you're going to have a tough time in the next 45 minutes. No, kidding, of course. The link between sleep health and metabolic health and the link between obesity and diabetes and apnea, they've talked about it for years. People in your line of work know about it. My question is, if you are obese, you're more likely to have sleep apnea. It constricts your breathing, right?
Yes.
So does sleep apnea cause diabetes and obesity, or is it the other way around?
Yes.
Yes?
It's bidirectional. It's essentially a Venn diagram
Okay. Between
obesity and metabolic health, that being insulin resistance, and sleep apnea. So when you have sleep apnea, your sleep is constantly being interrupted, and that increases your adrenaline levels, and that stresses your body. It makes your blood pressure go up, makes your heart rate go up. It interrupts your sleep and increases inflammation. And all these things lead to diabetes. Sleep loss itself, even in the absence of sleep apnea, increases your risk for developing insulin resistance and diabetes.
Interesting. Well, I have some personal questions about melatonin and things like that, but I'll get to that in a minute. For those who don't know, and by the way, we're joined by Dr. Alan Schaefer of St. Peter's Sleep Center today. The number is 800-348-2551, or you can email voxpop@wamc.org. For those who don't know, what is it that you do at the Sleep Center? Because it's so cool. I've done it once, and then I had to follow up, and this is years ago, but so many wires, so many things. I mean, it was crazy. But tell everyone who has never done it what it's like.
Okay. So first is we are a medical office. We have three physicians. We have two nurse practitioners, and we have a clinical psychologist. And we see patients like any office would on site at the sleep center. And we also do overnight sleep studies, sometimes in the sleep center. Sometimes we do studies that are done in the home.
Mm-hmm. How do you do them in the home? I mean,
they're basically a milder form, not as detailed.
Is that new? The telemetry must be incredible that you need to get.
It isn't. We don't use telemetry. Basically, we send the unit home with the patient.
Oh.
They put it on. They turn it on, put it on, take it off, turn it off, and they bring it back the next day, and we get a look at the data. So it's the only thing they monitor is airflow, respiratory effort, and oxygenation. They don't measure even sleep. So as a result, they are sometimes less reliable. They'll be more reliable if they show clear-cut sleep apnea. But a negative home sleep study isn't necessarily useful in ruling out sleep apnea. So a lot of times, a patient with a negative or a questionable home sleep study may then have to come in and sleep in the sleep center.
So if it was you suggesting to your patient, would you just say cut the middleman and just stay overnight at the sleep center and get wired up?
That's what I would prefer, but I don't pay for it. The insurance companies do.
Oh, I see.
And so most insurance companies insist on a home sleep study to start.
But to be clear, if you are of normal weight, and we'll get to that in a minute. We have some people calling in. One of them wants to know about healthy weight. We'll get to that in a second. But if you are normal weight, and you're a non-smoker, and your various other bad habits are not so bad, your odds are fairly low of getting apnea, right?
Right.
You got to be. If you're heavier, your odds are much better.
That's correct. In fact, 20% of people who are obese will have sleep apnea. 3% of non-obese people will have sleep apnea, and I am included in the latter. I'm one of those 3%.
But you lost 50 pounds.
I did.
And you still have apnea.
I still do because I have a small chin, and so it's called a craniofacial abnormality.
Uh-huh.
And that results in my tongue being closer to the back of the throat that narrows my upper airway. So I still have sleep apnea. And if I lost another 50 pounds, I would still have sleep apnea.
Ah, all right. Well, fair enough. Dr. Alan Schaefer is our guest today. We'll take a quick break and then we'll hit the phones. 800-348-2551 is our number. The email is voxpop@wamc.org. We'll be back. Gone way too soon. Jaco Pastorius, Three Views of a Secret here on Vox Pop. 800-348-2551 is the number. Dr. Alan Schaefer joins us from St. Peter's Sleep Center. Before we get to call number one here, quickly, let's talk a little bit about something I don't know too much about, the therapeutic carbohydrate restriction, why it's important in diabetes and obesity. I mean, carbs, we know carbs right. can be a bad thing in great profusion, but what's special about TCR?
So just to give you some background, we all know what diabetes is. Your blood sugar is too high, and there are two types of diabetes generally. Type 1, where we aren't able to make enough insulin, and type 2, where we have insulin resistance and as a result, too much insulin. The problem is that we've been treating these disorders the same way by focusing on controlling the glucose. In type 1, that's fine. You just give enough insulin. But if you give more insulin to somebody with type 2, you're actually worsening their insulin resistance because it's the high insulin levels that cause the insulin resistance.
Okay.
And insulin also makes you fat. No other way to put it.
Really?
And when you put on more fat, you develop more insulin resistance. You have more when you have more insulin resistance, your insulin levels go up even higher.
So it's a cycle that just...
And it's a vicious cycle.
Ah.
And as I tell my patients, the only way to break that vicious cycle is to lower your insulin level. And the only way to lower your insulin level is to lower your carbohydrate intake. So that's what therapeutic carbohydrate reduction is. I don't talk about it as a diet. I talk about it as a therapy because you're treating diabetes type 2 and you're not treating it to manage it. You're treating it to reverse the very condition that we were always taught was a persistent, chronic, debilitating condition.
Okay, but it still sounds like a diet. I mean,
it's a way you're going to change how you're eating. Absolutely,
right. And it's not something you can go off of in this case, right?
Well, it depends. Let me start by saying how much carbohydrate restriction is required. And that depends on the individual, mostly about how insulin resistant they are to begin with.
Yeah.
Okay. So they may have to cut way down if they have lots of insulin going on. And so if you get to the point like where I did, I was never diabetic, but I lost my 50 pounds back in 2008 with carbohydrate restriction. And I know that today, if I went out and had a slice of pizza, I would start gaining weight. My cravings would come back, I would eat four slices of pizza, and then and on and on.
But so you don't eat, you are saintly now. Is that the way you want to go through life?
Yeah.
Okay.
Because I want to feel this good.
Okay. You're feeling good.
And I'm healthy.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. The number here is 800-348-2551. Dr. Alan Schaefer joins us today from St. Peter's Sleep Center, who is at a convergence of sleep and obesity medicine, and it's really the twain has met many times before. Very quickly, before we hit the phones, Doc, let's talk about the plethora of weight loss drugs, this golden shining key for every American who's too lazy to do it on their own.
Well, thank you. First of all, I would not characterize people too lazy to do it on their own. The problem is that they're being given the wrong advice. They're being told to move more and eat less. And that doesn't work because if you're not restricting carbohydrates, it's not going to work. So the GLP-1 receptor agonists, I find, are useful tools in some circumstances. I use them as a tool, but my primary focus is on carbohydrate reduction. Okay, some people still struggle with it. They need a little bit of a kick. They may be dealing with food addiction issues, and those medicines are helpful with that. Okay, so I'll use it as a tool, but primarily primary carbohydrate reduction. So I'm also trained as a pulmonologist, although I'm not practicing that anymore. So just as an analogy, if I had a patient with emphysema, with COPD that was caused by smoking and exacerbated by smoking, and I gave that person oxygen, I gave them inhalers, but I wouldn't even ask how much they're smoking. And if they happened to tell me, I wouldn't say, you know what, just take these inhalers and oxygen. If you want to smoke, smoke. And frankly, that's what we're doing when we give people GLP-1s without also talking to them about carbohydrate reduction.
Interesting. So in your mind, and I don't want to put words in your mouth, it is overprescribed at this time.
I believe, yes, I do believe that, only because in so many cases it is being used as a substitute for therapeutic carbohydrate reduction rather than as an adjunct to it, which is, in my opinion, knowing the physiology, the pathophysiology of obesity and diabetes and insulin resistance, it should be used.
Dr. Alan Schaefer joins us today from St. Peter's Sleep Center. The number is 800-348-2551. Let's get to the phones. We'll check the email bag later. voxpop@wamc.org is the email. We'll start in West Hurley. Christopher, you're first. Go ahead.
Good afternoon, Ray and Dr. Schaefer. I work in public health, and there's a lot of discussion going around on this concept of healthy at any weight or healthy at any body type. And I guess I wanted to get your thoughts on what distinguishes that from truly risky or dangerous weight.
So thank you for that question. Two words, visceral fat. That is where the risk lies, okay? Not the fat that might be on your arms or jiggling in your belly, but the fat that's inside the abdomen and the fat that is inside your organs. That is the fat that is associated with inflammation and risk. So I'm not going to give you a BMI or a number per se, but the best estimate would be visceral fat. Does that help answer your questions,
or
you have follow-up?
Yes. Yes, it did. Thank you.
All right. Thanks a lot, Christopher. Appreciate the call. Dr. Alan Schaefer joins us from St. Peter's Sleep Center, 800-348-2551. To Stockbridge, Massachusetts. Rick, you're on.
Hi. Good afternoon, everyone.
Hi.
I got a problem that may stump you. I'll just tell you a quick bio. Back in 1997, I was one of seven people, according to Yale, who studied me afterwards, who caught this Australian strain of the flu, and of the seven, I'm the only one died. In 27, I couldn't eat for four days, couldn't drink anything for 2 days. And the fifth day, I lost close to 40 pounds of water, had a heart attack. Last time I heaved, and somebody found me 19 hours later. And since that time, I have not been able to sleep. I'm just going to roll my window up really quick here. Sorry, traffic going by. And I haven't been able to sleep for 27 years. And what they found in sleep studies, when I go to sleep, my brain wakes up. When I wake up, my brain goes asleep. And for the first 12 years, no doctor believed me, but they finally did a sleep study. They realized I wake up 16 times every hour. They put me on trazodone, which brought it down to 42 times an hour. And the doctor I'm seeing now at Bay State, he put me on Xywav, which is one of those date rape drugs. And I can't fall asleep on it. It basically puts me in this delta state where I'm almost ready to sleep, but it won't put me over. Last Thursday, Friday, and Saturday, I couldn't sleep at all. No sleep at all.
All right.
And I slept Saturday, but I think it was because I was so exhausted my body had to sleep.
Okay.
And I took it again last night, and I couldn't sleep at all. That's the story.
All right,
any
then,
idea what it
all right,
be?
Doc, what do you think?
Sounds like, I'm so sorry you're going through all this, but it sounds like you went through quite a bit back in 97. Having had a heart attack, I suspect you had a decreased blood flow perfusion to your brain that impacted your sleep center in some way that's not clear. It sounds like you have... it's not quite clear if you have hypersomnia, meaning very sleepy, or perhaps a variant of what we call secondary narcolepsy, which is why I think your doctor would put you on the sodium oxybate. And we do use that medication for idiopathic hypersomnia and for narcolepsy with great success, frankly. And your case sounds very, very complicated. It sounds like you're... if you're at Bay State, it sounds like you're in with a good sleep doctor. So,
Rick, did you say you died?
Well, they actually told me that night in the hospital that I wasn't going to live till the morning.
Huh.
I left the hospital. They told me I was going to die within 3 months. They sent me to Yale trying to figure out. They did a study trying to figure out why I lived. The doctor said I shouldn't have lived, and he gave me six months to live. And here we are 27 years
later. That's good, man. Well, I'm glad you're alive, and thank you for calling. 800-348-2551 is the number. Dr. Alan Schaefer joins us. Eileen writes in therapeutic carbohydrate reduction, what percent of calories would come from carbohydrate, protein, and fat?
Good question, and thank you again. I don't go by percentages. I generally talk to my patients about what foods, certainly whole foods is what I recommend, what their carbohydrate, protein, fat content might be, and make recommendations. The ketogenic diet, depending on how you do it, and that's what we're talking about with carbohydrate reduction, it can be 5% carbohydrates, 85% fat, that sort of, and there are variations. It also depends why you're putting somebody on that plan. It's been used for epilepsy. It's been used for other neurological things, psychiatric indications, in which case the carbohydrates need to be much more closely restricted. For reversing diabetes, again, I don't give people a percentage or an amount of carbohydrate per se, but we just talk about the food choices that we make.
Okay, let's go back to our goal.
Yes, I mean, some people will talk about 30 or 50 grams of carbohydrate, not net carbs.
All right, the number here is 800-348-2551. Something happened with our phones, and I believe the caller on line 7 is actually on the air. Let's pot it up, Mike, and see if this person's on the air, and we'll find out. There we are. Who are you, and why are you on my air?
Are you talking to me?
Yeah, I don't know. You're talking to me. Yeah, for some reason, your phone automatically phone went live, and so here you go. You're on.
Okay, this is Kathleen.
Hi.
So you're talking about carbohydrate reduction, and I get that. But do you just mean things like bread and potatoes and pasta, or do you mean all vegetables, all salad? And how do you get all your, you know, nutrients if you're cutting all of that out?
Aha. Uh-huh.
Okay. I do not count the carbs in that are in vegetables, such as cauliflower, asparagus, broccoli. And salads are certainly absolutely
recommended. I'm going to hang up because I can't hear you, so I can listen to the radio.
All right, Kathleen, thanks so much.
Okay.
Go ahead, doctor.
So, yes, we don't restrict vegetables. There are some carbohydrates in vegetables, but we don't restrict them. We recommend maybe no peas, no carrots, because they tend to be higher in carbohydrate. But we don't count the carbohydrates in broccoli, cauliflower, asparagus, et cetera.
Why?
What's that?
Why?
Because they have so many good micronutrients, and they give you fiber, and they fill you up. And the amount of carbohydrate isn't that much to spike your insulin level significantly.
Okay.
And that's what we're, again, focused on, the insulin level in type 2.
Fair enough. Well, that's it. All right, let's go back to the phones. 800-348-2551. Marie is in Del Mar. Hello, Marie.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. So I have a question about elderly people who don't sleep through the whole night because of pain that they're experiencing for, you know, possibly arthritis or something else. Is there something that they can do about that?
The answer to that is yes. There are a lot of things I would recommend. First, just a discussion with, you know, either your primary doctor or a sleep specialist, really going over your sleep habits in general. There are things like sleep hygiene, how much caffeine we take, what time do we go to bed, do we have a lot of screen time at night, are we watching TV? There are different behaviors that can impact your sleep either favorably or not. So certainly going over those things. And there's something called cognitive behavioral therapy of insomnia, which talks about looking at a patient's ideas regarding sleep and just educating folks and maybe adjusting some of those behaviors. Also, some medications might be helpful as well. I always recommend people exercise on a regular basis. As we get older, that might be more challenging for sure. But if not, you know, strong exercise, at least activity. Also, it's important to go to bed more or less the same time every night, eat your meals the same time every day. This helps regulate your circadian rhythm as well.
What if you're, Marie, thank you for the call. Appreciate it. What if you work at night and you never see the sun? What happens?
That is difficult. There's a sleep disorder called shift work sleep disorder. And it's one of the circadian rhythms because people work all night and then they go to bed and sleep all day.
Yeah.
And then you have severe circadian misalignment where outside is telling it's light, but your body is saying it's time to sleep. And at night, when your body wants to sleep, your work schedule is saying it's time to work. And there are different things you can do about that. Having rotating shifts is also very challenging for people.
Yeah.
Like do days, evenings, and then nights. And that's probably the worst of it. But it would require, you know, again, regulating your sleep times during the day, you know, a short sleep time during the day, maybe a nap before you go to work. The times that you eat during the day or at night, regulating that as well. And it could be very challenging for some people.
Is there a way that our bodies will not compensate, but shift our cycle, our circadian rhythm so that, you know, it all works out in the end? If I went and lived on Mars, obviously it's a different orbit and everything else. I would have to make do.
Yeah. So it's interesting that our natural circadian rhythm isn't 24 hours, but it's 24.2 hours. So it's a natural delay night after night. But our ambient light does what's called entrains our circadian rhythm to keep it more or less constant. One of the things that happens is when we hit puberty, there's about a two-hour delay, maybe 1 to 2 hour delay in our circadian rhythm. So if you have a teenage child who was sleeping so well and all of a sudden they're up all hours of the night, that's part of why. But then you have a teenager and the social aspect of being a teenager and adolescence and screen time and social time, that delays it even farther. So nighttime exposure to light worsens the circadian rhythm that way. So by adjusting our light exposure, when we encourage light exposure, when we try to avoid light exposure or minimize it, we can also take supplemental melatonin to help shift the circadian rhythm, and that's off. But this should be done under the guise of a sleep specialist,
because
it's really complicated, and there are different kinds of circadian rhythm issues.
Thank you very much for bringing, again, melatonin up. Where do you stand on its use? How much is too much? If someone says, gosh, I can't sleep, I'm going to slam a couple melatonin gummies and I'll sleep like a baby for 6 or 7 hours. How often is too much for someone?
Regular use is not recommended.
Well, what does that mean?
In other words, if you use it on a nightly basis, then it will lose its effect and it will be hard to get off of it.
But what do you mean? So if someone does it once a week, is that regular use?
I would say that is probably reasonably safe.
Interesting.
To use. Yeah.
All right, let's grab one more call, then we'll take a break, then we'll go back to the phones. Interesting today with Dr. Alan Schaefer from St. Peter's Sleep Center. Number is 800-348-2551. What say we head out to Pennsylvania? Jim in Matamoros, you're on.
Does the microthrombosis associated with COVID predominantly affect the lungs or other organs equally?
Microthrombosis connected to COVID, does it affect the lungs or what do you think, Doc?
Yes, and yes, and yes. I mean, COVID is such an awful disease, and we found it to be a thrombotic disease eventually, and that made it still challenging to treat. But yeah, it certainly affects the lungs. I've seen it. It affects other organs. People with COVID were getting strokes.
All right, Jim, thanks for the call. Let's take a break. 800-348-2551. It's Dr. Alan Schaefer on this Medical Monday from St. Peter's Sleep Center. Here's some nice relaxing Frank Zappa to take you to the next sleep cycle.
Thank you.
It's Vox Pop. It's Medical Monday. Ray Graff with you. We're joined by Dr. Alan Schaefer from St. Peter's Sleep Center. And let's grab a couple emails here before we go back to the phones. This one's from Andrew. All right. I feel your pain here, Andrew. Is there an ideal mattress, or is it really up to us to decide what is the right mattress? Are there any mattress types you'd not recommend?
It is a very individualized thing. Some people like hard, some people like soft. I myself like memory foam. I like my mattress softer. My wife's likes it more firm.
Oh, so do you have one of those things, like she's got one setting and you got the other setting?
No. But we're okay.
I was going to do that, but then I would have to take a second mortgage out to do it, so I'm not doing it.
There's that.
Yeah.
But no, it's really a very individualized trial and error thing. I don't endorse any particular kind of mattress.
I, you know, at different times in my life, I have slept on wooden futon and basically a floorish type thing. Back was never better. Sleep was never better. Mm-hmm. Is that, I mean, should we all be sleeping on the floor?
There's something to be said for that, especially what mattress you might have had before that.
Yeah.
I might say, on a personal note, I have had back problems since I'm 12 years old, and I sleep in a zero gravity recliner.
What the heck's that?
And it just, it reclines me all the way back. My head is all the way down, and my body and my back and legs and knees are flexed in such a way like the astronauts
would. So you're upside down, like you're about to take off.
Close to it.
Doesn't all the blood rush to your head?
I was going to be a wise guy. No, it's not that much lower, but, it was a game changer for me.
Really? Yeah. I've never heard of such a thing. Yeah. All right. This email from Joe, and then we'll go back to the phones. 800-348-2551 is the number. Joe writes, what's the best way to measure how much visceral fat there is? What exercises focus on visceral fat more?
So, any body composition testing can probably give you visceral fat. I'm not up on those. There's plethysmography, the scales where you grab the bars. There's a DEXA scanning, which I'm not very familiar with, so forgive me for not really having a great answer on that.
Okay.
The thing about visceral fat is that if you have a high level of visceral fat and you do exercise and you do practice carbohydrate reduction, your visceral fat should go down. It's best for it to be in the single digits. Mine this morning was 8%.
How do you measure it?
By getting on a scale, and it measures body fat and it gives you an estimate of visceral fat. If you really want to do it, you can get an MRI of your abdomen or a CT of your abdomen,
and that
can give you a real visual and a true percentage.
Is this a new thing? Because I've a lifetime of fattydom, and I've never heard of visceral. I never knew I was visceral.
Yeah.
Is this a new discovery?
Not at all.
Okay. Let's go to my doctors must have been keeping it from me. Let's go to Queensbury. Tommy, you're on. How you doing?
Hey, thanks for taking my call.
You bet.
I go to sleep at night, like most of us, and I'm usually breathing normal through both my nasal cavity and my mouth. After about 5-10 minutes, I'm laying down. My nose gets clogged up. I start breathing through my mouth. My mouth gets dry, and I get very distracted, and it makes it hard for me to go to sleep. If I for any reason get up in the middle of the night, and when I go back to sleep, when I do get up in the middle of the night, I'm very conscious that, look at me, I'm breathing through my nose so clearly. So while I sleep, my nose tends to clear up. Any idea what that's all about?
Interesting.
I've not heard that one. I can't really say. I mean, certainly if you have nasal breathing issues, seeing an ear, nose, throat doctor is probably recommended. Can it impact your sleep? Many people with nasal congestion, that's one of the things that can worsen sleep apnea, so that might be something to look into as well. And there are certainly some nasal sprays, some medicines that can be used for nasal congestion. Allergy testing might be another thing you may want to look at.
Mm. Okay, thank you.
All right, man. Thanks for the call. 800-348-2551. Let's go to Judy, who's in Hudson. Hello, Judy, who's in Hudson.
Hi, I'm calling about weight loss. I'm in my 70s and have been very active until I had two falls, and now I can barely walk. And I'm wondering about
I tried Ozempic and got violently ill.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering if there's another medication I can take that doesn't have those awful ingredients in it.
Oh, yeah. Boy.
One of the side effects of the GLP-1s is it slows down your stomach emptying, so it can lead to nausea and vomiting. I don't tend to focus on the medications per se, but only as a tool to help people who are already practicing carbohydrate restriction. So if you're in need of weight loss, you can certainly consider something like that. If you're of the idea that because it's hard to move, to exercise, that you need medication to lose weight, is that what I'm hearing from you, Judy?
Yeah, that's the problem, because I just mostly sit.
Yeah, so the thing is that if you do change the way you eat towards carbohydrate reduction, exercise is not required to lose the weight. It's not about calories in, calories out. It's about reducing the amount of insulin that your body produces, which allows you to then burn the fat that you do have, if that makes sense.
Does it make sense?
It does.
Oh, good.
Okay, I'll try it. Thank you.
Thanks, Judy. 800-348-2551 is our telephone number. Dr. Alan Schaefer joins us from St. Peter's Sleep Center, and we'll go to Debbie, who's in Albany. Debbie, you're on.
Hello.
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 Hi.
Hello, can you hear me?
Yes. Can you hear us?
Okay. Yes.
Okay.
So here's my question. I have some moderate insomnia, mainly the kind where you wake up at night and the brain is going. It's hard to get it down. My doctor wanted me to do Ambien, which I was fearful of for different reasons, you know. So I finally conceded it. She did a 5-milligram dose. I might take a 5-milligram tablet once a week or every other week because I'm afraid of tolerance, you know, and needing more. Or I'll take almost a negligible dose of 2.5, cut it in half. But a sleep doctor I knew had mentioned a drug called Quivivic.
Quivivic.
Have you heard of that?
Yes.
Yes, yes. And I was wondering, would that be less... nicer to take, shall I say, than Ambien.
All right.
So Zolpidem or Ambien is, there are some people that get what we call parasomnias.
Great. Go ahead, Doc.
Zolpidem or Ambien is sometimes associated with certain what we call parasomnias. People can sleepwalk. And there are certainly a lot of stories about.
Okay. Well, why don't you listen off air, and we're going to talk about what Ambien is and does, and then we'll talk a little bit about Quivivic or whatever that new thing is. So why don't you listen on the air? All right, Debbie, thanks a lot. Doctor, go.
So, yes. So there are some people that have that side effect, so it's been it can be very concerning. Some people are also concerned about long-term use. For me, in dealing with patients, I always weigh the price of long-term medication use versus long-term sleep loss, stress, anxiety. Sleep loss often is a risk factor for depression, and it can exacerbate chronic pain. It can affect many other disorders as well, like we talked about insulin resistance, diabetes. So I like to weigh the positives and the negatives. The Quivivic, I don't, in the top of my head, have the generic name for it, but it's another class of sleep aids that you can talk to your primary or your or a sleep specialist about. Yeah, I sometimes prescribe that as well.
Ambien was very big for a number of years some time ago, and have doctors sort of pulled that back from the state of the art, or is it still widely prescribed?
It's not as widely prescribed as it originally was.
Yeah.
So we're a bit more mindful about the possible long-term use.
So here's something. If you prescribe something like Ambien or whatever this new thing is, and people sleep soundly, but they have apnea, are they putting themselves at risk?
Good question. So some sleep aids can worsen or exacerbate sleep apnea. So if I have somebody with insomnia and I'm concerned that they might have sleep apnea as well, many times I will say, let's do a sleep study. And if you do have sleep apnea, we'll get you on the CPAP first, and then we'll talk about medications. Although there are some medications that don't significantly impact sleep apnea, some sleep aids.
Okay, let's go back to our phones with Dr. Alan Schaefer from St. Peter's Sleep Center, and let's see here. All right, we'll go to Great Barrington, and it's Jim's turn. Hello, Jim.
Hello, Ray and Doctor. Thanks for taking my call. I'm just about 80 and still kicking and very active, but I've been diagnosed with prediabetes recently, and I also have a little bit of fatty liver, and also take levothyroxine for hypothyroid for a number of years. I'm just wondering, I'm not sure whether the reduction of carbohydrates is appropriate for me or how I should best approach the prediabetes condition.
So if you're asking me what diet might be appropriate for somebody with prediabetes, I would say that carbohydrate restriction, in my opinion, is the best recommendation I can make. And again, I work with my patients in terms of designing the things to eat, see what works for them, et cetera.
Great. Thanks very much. Appreciate it.
Thank Jim, you. Thanks for listening, and thanks for the call. The number is 800-348-2551. Here's one from Matt in the 845 in New Paltz. In regards to insulin resistance, how does that apply to endurance athletes during exercise? We tend to eat between 60 and 100 grams of carbs per hour, mostly as simple sugars, during hard exercise of 2 to 6 hour durations to maintain required energy levels. I monitored my glucose levels for 2 weeks using a continuous glucose monitor and never saw any high glucose levels. But can that amount of sugar affect insulin resistance if it's all immediately used by the muscles?
That is an awesome question. Thank you, Matt. I would say that if you're one of the people who can exercise to the point of using the sugar in your system as you ingest it, and you're not spiking your glucose, I think that's terrific. If you are spiking your glucose, you probably are developing insulin resistance. I know that there are many endurance athletes, just to sort of shift my answer to your question, who practice carbohydrate restriction and they become what's called fat adapted. So basically when they need energy, they go to their fat stores before even their carbohydrates.
Uh-huh.
And there have been long distance, not just long distance runners, but, you know, the 100-mile kind of guys that have done this and have won races, in fact, doing it. So if you are interested in some such thing. So there are, and these folks don't tend to have that. Again, I'm not I'm anything but an athlete. And I've never run a marathon. Maybe I used to do a 5K, but
that counts.
I'll take it. But if there's something I understand, it's called hitting the wall, and that's generally not seen in people that are fat adapted from low carb diets. And I understand that does happen with long distance runners, and it's likely from using their carbohydrate. Again, I'm not expert in that particular field, but there are some people that are, if you look up people like Jeff Volek, V-O-L-E-K,
Go ahead.
He's with Virta Health, V-I-R-T-A Health, in Ohio. He's expert in terms of endurance athletes and carbohydrate restriction. He's also part of a practice that has been doing carbohydrate restriction for their diabetics and shown remarkable results, getting more than half of their patients off of insulin. It's just incredible.
And all right, Dr. Alan Schaefer, we have a few minutes left here. Let's try to grab a couple of more calls. We have several people on the line. Let's go to Stone Ridge. John, you're on. Go ahead. Try to make it quick if you can.
Hey, Doctor. Thank you very much for taking my call, Ray. My name is John, and I've been blind for 30 years, and I've never been able to correct my change in rhythm. I wake up every day, no matter when I go to bed or what I take. I wake up at dawn or before. I'm always exhausted. If I take more meds, I wake up groggy. I'm at the end of my rope. I don't know what else to try.
Yeah. I mean, that light is what entrains our circadian rhythm. often makes it very difficult to manage folks. Have you seen a sleep specialist?
No, not directly. I've been talking to my doctor for a long time about this. I try to get in the winter. I actually sit outside. I put my face in it. You can get UV through your neck or through the back of your knees. I've really looked into almost everything, but never an exact sleep doctor. I'm going to be talking to her tomorrow, so and see if she has any of the suggestions. And, you know, everything, melatonin, natural things, every kind of low end, not any kind of super strong things for sleep, things like Ambien and Temazepam.
Right.
And they work, but it's just so bizarre that no matter what I do, when I go to bed or what I eat, I cut down on coffee, a good diet, I'm a vegetarian. I just want to sleep until 8 o'clock, in the morning, get up and have my day at work.
Okay. I could have a lot to say,
yeah,
but we're trying to make it quick.
So
but
enjoy.
I would,
I
would be in favor of your seeing a sleep physician so they can really look to you and look for possible other coexistent sleep disorders that might be causing your problem, or it could just be that that this may be how things are going to be, that you can't start your day till 8 if that's the issue. But I would definitely recommend a consultation.
John, thanks for the call. Really appreciate it. This email from Cheryl, who says, I recently heard of something called silent snoring. What is that, and how would one know they have it? You're looking blankly at me. Have you not heard of this?
I have not heard of silent snoring.
No? Most listeners to this show, I think, are well familiar with it. But let's see. We'll go to Terry in Longmeadow. Terry, you have 20 seconds tops. Go.
My question has to do with description between simple carbohydrates and complex carbohydrates.
Okay. So by complex carbohydrates, you mean the starches, breads, pasta, potatoes, et cetera, right?
I mean things like vegetables and grains.
Okay.
Which are not processed or pre-digested.
Sure.
Okay.
Well, in terms of simple carbs, that's simple sugars like sweets. The way I look at complex carbohydrates, not so much that's in vegetables, again, which I'm not concerned about, and I recommend vegetables. But the starches are considered complex carbohydrates as far as I know. And basically, complex carbohydrates may raise your blood sugar more slowly, but they still raise your blood sugar. So there's something called the glycemic index, which raises your...
Go ahead, keep
which,
going.
Talks about how fast your blood sugar goes up, but it's really the glycemic load, or how much carbohydrate you actually take in, that is more is going to be more impactful and indicative of your metabolic health.
I'm afraid, Dr. Schaefer, and I got a feeling you're on a roll, and we could do 3 hours here, but we have to wrap it up here. So how do people find out about St. Peter's Sleep Center? And it does amazing things. I mean, it changed my life when I went there.
Yeah.
And so how do people find it?
Well, am I allowed to give the phone number?
Sure.
518-464-9999.
Okay.
And it'll be a pleasure to meet any and all of you.
Good job, man. Thank you so much. I learned a lot today. Appreciate it. I hope you come back.
Thank you so much for having me. I'd be glad to.
Support comes from CHP Berkshires, providing medical and dental care for patients of all ages in the Berkshires, plus women's health through the lifespan. CHP Mobile Health on the road with same-day care for minor illness. CHPBerkshires.org. Once again, thanks to Dr. Alan Schaefer of St. Peter's Sleep Center for being with us today. It was a good show today. Thank you for being part of it and making those questions and calling and emailing. Thanks to Mike Bowen. Beautiful job there at the board, sir, and master control. Bob Rathman screened the calls. No less than wonderful. I'm Ray Graff. Tomorrow it's burning. Rich Guthrie will be here. We'll see you, too.